Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. Vermont's official state motto is freedom and unity. Its unofficial motto must be see snow, find some crazy new way to ride down a mountain on it. My transports of choice since I've moved to Vermont have been the snowboard and extreme sleds, in particular the hammerhead. But my next guest has been a backcountry skier since the 80s. He's an expert on the subject and has written a new book on the subject called Best Backcountry Skiing in the Northeast, 50 Classic Ski and Snowboard Tours in New England and New York. He's also the host of the Vermont Conversation on WDEV. David Goodman, it's great to have you on Vermont Viewpoint.
It's great to be here with you, Rick.
Thanks for being here. Listeners, if you've got questions for David or if you want to share some great tales of backcountry skiing, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. And our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. All right, we're going to start off with the basics, David. What exactly is backcountry skiing?
Well, I like to think of backcountry skiing as skiing anywhere where that it's white. So you're not bounded by, you know, ski area boundaries or other things, but instead you can look up at your favorite summit and wonder, is there a way to ski up and down that place? And the answer is almost certainly yes. This has a long history in Vermont. People have been looking at those summits at least since the 1920s and 30s. So we're talking about a century, and figuring out ways to get down the mountain and, in fact, creating trails to do just that. So a lot of what I've done over the years that I've been writing the Northeast's only backcountry skiing guidebooks is kind of reconnecting our present with our past and finding many of those historic trails. And many of those trails have now been restored. So there is skiing just about everywhere in Vermont and beyond.
Well, David, would this have been the, like, original form of skiing or original form of downhill skiing?
It is. Today, we have to be hyper-specific when we say we're going skiing. Are you going cross-country skiing, downhill skiing, backcountry skiing, splitboarding, snowboarding? Well, back in the 1930s, there was one ski, and you went skiing. And that ski had a cable, and the cable would be free and allow your heel to lift so you could ski uphill with skins strapped to the bottom of your skis. Or when it came time to descend, you would lock down the cable and you would have essentially a downhill binding. But skiing was just one thing, and it was basically the invention and the advent of chairlifts that led to this hyper-specialization that we have today, where people go into, you know, a ski shop and they are understandably a little intimidated and confused as they look at a wall of skis, each of which does something different. Some is for groomed snow, some is for backcountry snow, some is for racing. So that really, that kind of segmentation occurred starting in the 1940s when, you know, the first chairlifts went up in the late 30s. And that transformed the landscape of Vermont, and it also transformed skiing so that you had to now choose. Did you, you know, have equipment just for going downhill with a chairlift, or did you have equipment that enabled you to continue to go exploring in the backcountry?
Did backcountry go out of vogue then in the 40s when the chairlifts and groomed runs started to come into vogue?
It almost vanished. Mm. There was the heyday of backcountry skiing, and people are often very surprised to hear this, was the 1930s. It was a brief moment before chairlifts came. I think Stowe's first lift was a single chairlift in 1938. And right in that era, you know, within about 5 years of that, chairlifts were going up on all the highest peaks. So just prior to that was the heyday, the golden era of backcountry skiing. And that's when trails were being cut and people were coming in large numbers from the cities. There were snow trains coming from Penn Station in New York and North Station in Boston up to the North Country, and people were coming out and using skis to ski uphill, and they were and then descending on them. Thousands of people were coming north every weekend from the cities to go backcountry skiing. With the arrival of chairlifts, you know, that was a pretty neat invention.
Right.
Suddenly you didn't have to, you know, invest all this sweat equity to get where you were going. So I would say that, you know, backcountry skiing went into this extended period of dormancy. And I think the kind of the gradual reawakening coming, I first began writing about backcountry skiing in the mid-1980s. And I was, at that time, I was working as an outdoor instructor for Outward Bound in the Adirondacks. And a friend who is now a Vermonter, Todd Eastman, was a fellow instructor. And he said, you know, you should write about the renaissance of backcountry skiing in the Northeast. And I confess, I didn't really know what he was talking about. But he explained that he and a bunch of others were sort of pioneering, exploring all the high peaks on skis, and they weren't necessarily inventing their own trails. They were going in search of these old trails. So in 1988, the winter of 1988, I was asked by the Appalachian Mountain Club. This came out of the blue. I was a budding freelance writer, and I had just written an article based on the advice that Todd had given me. I'd written an article called The Northeastern Renaissance for Cross Country Skier Magazine, which is now based in Vermont, by the way, but back then it wasn't. And the Appalachian Mountain Club had seen the article and called me and said, would I write a book about ski? They really didn't know. You know, the AMC was a hiking organization. It was their first book on skiing. I was told later that it was very controversial internally for them to venture into something other than hiking. But so they asked me, would I write a book? And since they didn't know much about skiing, they left it to me to decide what it should be about.
Hmm.
So I wrote a book about skiing, you know, sort of rediscovering all the trails that had been cut in the 1930s, many of which were being maintained by enthusiastic locals. So it was sort of a hyper-local thing. You know, in Underhill, you'd have the Teardrop Trail cut in the 1930s, and locals there just, they loved skiing it. So they kept clearing the trail and keeping it alive. Well, there were examples of that all across the Northeast. I basically lived out of my car and went back and forth finding and skiing a lot of these things. Some of these were bust. That's the secret misery of a guidebook author, you know. You have to ski a lot more than you have to go, you know, explore a lot more than you write about, because a lot of what you explore isn't all that good.
Yeah.
And that doesn't make the book. So, but to your original question, you know, did it kind of vanish? So my book comes out in 1988, and I literally thought it was going to sell 100 copies and I would know 95 of the people who bought them. I didn't tell my publisher that. They of course always had, you know, dreams of bestsellers. Well, much to my shock, and I was probably more surprised than anybody, a lot of people snapped up this book, and it sold thousands of copies and was part of really a revival of backcountry skiing that has continued, and I would say has really peaked in a way that I certainly couldn't anticipate with, you know, in this current moment when I've just come out with the fourth edition of this book. I've done them every 10 years.
David, in the 80s and back in the 30s, was it called backcountry skiing at that point?
Well, in the 30s, it wasn't. It was just called skiing.
Right.
They had another name for it. They sometimes called it walk-up skiing because that's how you got to the top of the trail you skied. They also called it down-mountain skiing because that was sort of the reward for your efforts was you got to ski down the mountain. And then I would say the term just went away. People didn't know what to call it. You know, a lot of people sort of, it was sort of left to cross-country skiers to do this thing where you skied uphill because certainly, you know, alpine skis, the things you use at ski areas, they couldn't go uphill.
Right.
Those were getting heavier and clunkier, and they were absolutely, you know, they were skis with a chair built into them. They could only follow gravity.
Right.
I think the term came back. You know, my book in the 1980s, the very first edition was called Classic Backcountry Skiing. And the term was, you know, out there. It just didn't have a lot of followers. There were some guidebooks in the West that spoke of backcountry skiing, but it was really just the beginning of something that has exploded into the mainstream now.
David, what is it that you love about backcountry compared to, say, alpine skiing?
I guess I love winter, and I love finding ways to be out in winter that gets away from the crowds and doesn't, I do love skiing at ski areas. I'm a big fan of the glades at Stowe and Mad River Glen, you know, there is something about pushing off under your own steam into the winter wilderness that is just thrilling. And I also love wild snow. That's snow that hasn't been groomed. It just, and it's very often powder snow. Sometimes it's tricky because it's not so powdery and not so easy to ski. But I love figuring all that out and taking whatever Mother Nature throws at you and just, you know, getting to a high viewpoint in winter and looking out where the only sound you hear is of snowflakes falling on your jacket or on the branches around you it's an indescribable, incomparable feeling. There's nothing quite like it. And it only lasts for a short time. Some people feel like winters in Vermont are endless, but I kind of have, since as somebody who loves winter, I always feel like it's not long enough. And certainly this winter has been really tested our patience. There hasn't been enough snow to backcountry ski until really this past weekend. There's been enough to downhill ski and cross-country ski. But, you know, you needed to get some depth to build up to cover all the downed branches and trees and such. And we are finally there in this area, I would say north of Route 2, and south as well. But the northern half of Vermont is now fully in condition. So there's lots of places to go. I'll add another sort of just personal anecdote about what I loved about it. As is often the case with some new passion that you take up, there's probably another passion involved. I was just trying to find a way to keep up with my then new girlfriend, now wife, who was a much better skier than me. And one of our early dates was we were going to school in Boston, to college in Boston, and we went to Killington, and I had never skied with her before, and she went down this nasty, icy mogul field and just made it look effortless. So naturally, being a 20-something guy, I assumed, I guess it's easy. So I started down, made two or three turns, and just began cartwheeling and yard sailing with my gear strewn all around the slope and landed at her feet and suffered the ultimate indignity of, you know, having my girlfriend go around and pick up my gear around the slope. So backcountry skiing for me was, it was something I enjoyed, but it was also a way to keep up with her. I figured if I could remove half of her ski binding, that being the heel piece, and we started telemark skiing, that maybe she'd slow down and I'd speed up and we'd meet in the middle. And that is mostly proven to be true, but I will say she has never stopped being my skiing inspiration. She's still a really beautiful skier.
And we all know that skier, that's Sue Minter, who has been a state representative. She oversaw the comeback efforts after Irene, and now is executive director of Capstone Community Action. You mentioned telemark. Is that different, the same as backcountry skiing?
So telemark is really just a heavy-duty cross-country ski. So if you you know your cross-country ski, the way your heel is free but your toe is attached to the ski, telemark uses a heavy plastic boot, not similar to a downhill boot, and a heavy-duty binding and big wide skis, much like alpine skis. So you have the free heel enabling you to go on the flats or go uphill, but you have the heavy-duty boots and bindings that enable you to ski downhill. So it really backcountry telemark skis and skiing was kind of the main way you had to backcountry ski for the last few decades. But the major change that's happened, and you know, people often ask me when I write these things every 10 years, what changes? to which I reply, well, everything. And I got to say, this last decade has been an era of the most remarkable change that I've seen in the times that I've been doing this. And some of that relates to equipment. And that has to do with the fact that there is now you have alpine touring equipment, or AT skis, as it's called, which is essentially downhill skis where the binding allows you to lift your heel and go uphill and downhill. And the big difference there is that it now means that basically if you can ski, you can backcountry ski. You don't have to learn a new, you know, turn, the telemark turn. You don't have to have, you do need these specialized bindings, but it's downhill skis and boots and bindings. So the bar to entry to backcountry skiing has been practically eliminated, and that's very exciting. And we are seeing part of the result. I would say a perfect storm has come together right now in the world of backcountry skiing, which has to do with this equipment, which makes it so easy to backcountry ski. The desire, I think, for people to get back to nature and you know, sort of find community. But the third thing, unfortunately, of course, is COVID. And, you know, people want to ski, but they want to avoid crowds. Mm-hmm. Well, that happens right at this moment where equipment has evolved to the point where it has made backcountry skiing really easy to do.
Outstanding.
So, yeah.
Let's take a call. We're going to go to Corinth, and Wade is calling in. Hi, Wade.
Hey, good morning. Good morning to your guest. And not sure if he's familiar with us over here. A few WDEV listeners might be, but I'm on the board and work on a crew over here at Northeast Slopes in Corinth. And I don't know if your listener is familiar with us or not.
Yes, and I am familiar with Northeast Slopes. I've been listening to Ken Squire and Leakytown broadcast from there for years.
Yeah. We have a lot of fun over here. All volunteer, you know, nonprofit, and just making sure we keep it all good and affordable for everybody. But we date back to that gray zone between, you know, the walk-up skiing, which all was available in the early 30s. Of course, we weren't first, but we were second to put any mechanical lift on a hill in United States for skiing. And of course, then they were rope toes. They predated, you know, any of the chairlifts, either out west or even at Mount Mansfield, just by a couple of years. But there they were. And that was the heyday of uphill, you know, lifts to get people to then be able to ski downhill. You know, the White Cupboard and Woodstock and Suicide 6 all have the claim to the first one. But of course, there's no rope toe left down there now in any original form. And we've kept that there's a marker. Yeah, there's a historical marker.
That's right.
And the only difference is there you have a historical marker, and we're a living history, because the days that we run that, you can get a hold of that original tow line, and some of the wheels and equipment are some of the original stuff from 36, and you can experience what it was like, you know, 85 years ago to go back there and grab hold of a rope and get up the hill probably faster than most people come down.
What a wonderful slice of history. Wade, we're going to have you on the show sometime to talk all about Northeast Slopes
history. And we've had a tough time so far this year because we have all natural snow, no snowmaking.
Oh, that's right.
Rely on what's I'm looking out the window is falling right now. And so we've been open a few days, and we're a couple weeks behind of our usual schedule. But we're seeing the same thing, and I've actually, not guilty, but actually have the pleasure myself of starting to do some uphill skinning, and we're seeing more and more people do that. And I know our ski shop that I work with said the same thing. You know, with the COVID scare, everything flew off the shelves. It was just like kayaks and bicycles in the summer. Because there is a fear in the back of our minds that all ski areas could be shut down at some point, a lot like they are in Europe. And what are you going to do then? Well, you better put on the skins and start hiking up if you think you're going to be coming down. And we see more and more of that there when the lifts are running and even when they're not running. And we have a little bit of woods, a little bit of glades, and in the past few years we've seen a trend towards telemark and skins, or people riding the lifts and then skinning off a little higher into the terrain and then skiing our glades. So, yeah, it's a big thing. And if you ever want to go back and look at a really good historical piece on our backstory page of northeastslopes.org, is it about a five-minute video. It says 1950, but I think it's late 40s. And look at the heyday of what was going on there, even at those small ski areas, which then were not considered small ski areas. They were the happening place. There must be 400 people in that video skiing up and down that rope toe. It's just fantastic to go back and look at it.
Excellent. Thanks, Wade, for that call. We only have about a minute before the break.
I want to add something to,
sure, David,
to what Wade just said, and I think Northeast Slopes is just a fantastic place for people to experience skiing that is not glitzy and expensive. But the other thing is, a lot of these old ski areas, some which didn't make it, like Ascutney, Dutch Hill, these are all, you know, around Vermont, mm-hmm. are being reclaimed by backcountry skiers. So there's a new life for the old ski areas now.
Oh, that's fantastic. I love to hear that. You know, the one thing that's got me tired out is you guys talking about skiing or skinning up a mountain. I just don't know that I have. Of course, I'm old and I'm dying here, so, you know, the knees are going, but oh my goodness. Yeah, the chairlift was whoever came up with that in the 40s had me in mind rather than having to hike up a mountain like that. We're going to take a break, David. It is time for CBS News. And then we're going to get back to chatting about backcountry skiing with David Goodman. Great time to call. We've got a couple calls lined up for after the break. We've got David Goodman here up till 11. Our number's 244-1777. You can also reach us toll-free at 877-291-8255. That's 877-291-TALK. Or you can email us, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Here we are into January, still in a pandemic, but there is hope on the horizon. At the Warren Store, renovations are wrapping up. The new deli is rocking hard with old favorites and new menu items like French fries. The grab-and-go dinners are to die for, delicious, generous, full-course meals. Check out our website, warrenstore.com, for daily offerings. Upstairs, we have a new look in the ladies' department and, wait for it, heat and air conditioning. Still fun, friendly, and funky. Main Street, Warren Village. New hours, 7:30 to 5 o'clock daily.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri, and we're knee-deep in some beautiful powder as we learn all about backcountry skiing with David Goodman. Yes, the same David Goodman who hosts the Vermont Conversation Wednesday afternoons at 1 here on WDEV. He has a new book out, his fourth on backcountry skiing, and he's here to tell us all about everything he knows about the sport. And we're taking your calls at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. We're going to go right back to the phones and speak with Brian, who's calling from Washington. Good morning, Brian. Go right ahead.
Good morning. Can you hear me all right?
Very well.
Yeah. So I'm 64, and I can remember when I was a kid getting together with, you know, my brothers and sisters and cousins and uncles, my dad and all. And we had, of course, old wooden skis with cable bindings, and we'd unhitch the back part of the cable, and then we were able to go on the back trails. And I remember distinctly going up Wright's Mountain I don't know if we were on the Newbury side or the Bradford side there, but just having a blast, just you know, going up there. I didn't know if it was a regular trail. I don't know, David, is that a specific trail going up Wright's Mountain, or
I don't know the mountain, but it's, you know, there's such a tradition in Vermont of creating local trails for people to ski. And now that tradition has gotten a new lift because there are all these grassroots ski groups, community-supported skiing, I call it, kind of like CSAs, but for skiing. And there's one, there's the Northeast Kingdom Backcountry Coalition. There's Rasta, which is Randolph Rochester. And they are cutting big glades and trails all throughout areas that haven't had them before, or they're restoring trails that were maybe barely there, and now they've turned them into great ski trails. So the Catamount Trail Association and their website, catamounttrail.org, lists all these groups, and you may well find that your area has one of these community-supported skiing groups that is developing new terrain. So every year now, there is terrain that didn't exist a year before to go backcountry skiing.
Oh, that's exciting. All right, let's take a call now from Peter, who's joining us from Montpelier. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, how you doing? Hello, you there?
We are. You might want to turn your radio down, Peter.
Okay, I did, thank you.
Okay.
Mainly, I wanted to mention regarding, like, equipment. I once made a pair of skis with a, you know, a couple of pallet flats and just sort of shiplapped aluminum flashing on the side of a plastic bucket to make the curve in the front. And I spent the day in the Knox Mountains way up. And I just really enjoyed how slow these skis were. I mean, on one hand, I could just march right over brush piles and stuff. But the beauty of it was I could take a really steep slope, cutting a beeline anywhere I wanted to go in the woods. I could take a steep slope and just cruise down. You know, I wasn't like on the Black Diamond at 90 miles an hour. I had no interest.
Yeah. David, as he describes, you know, going down at a slower pace, that's interesting. So I'm one who has not backcountry skied. So kind of describe, you know, what it is like to descend on these trails as opposed to, you know, coming down on Stowe.
Well, you know, these, if they're trails that have been cut for backcountry skiing, they normally have room to make turns, to keep your speed in check. And, you know, as with trails at a downhill ski area, they, you know, there are steeper ones and less steep ones. I should also point out that, you know, backcountry skiing doesn't necessarily have to include big downhills. It can just be skiing in the woods. That's backcountry skiing, too. And a lot of people prefer to keep their travels to the valley floors, and that's just fine. And you have equipment for it. And I also just want to pick up on what the caller was saying. You know, I love what he's doing, you know, improvising skis.
Right.
It doesn't have to be expensive to get equipment. I was just talking to a fellow who goes to the Restore or Resource, I think it is, the secondhand store where you can get everything from kitchen sinks, but you can also get skis. So there's skis available throughout Vermont, and of course the ski swaps, most of which did not happen this year because of the pandemic, but for years I've been outfitting my family at ski swaps. There's very good equipment there at very low cost. So, you know, this being Vermont, it wouldn't be the case if you were closer to, you know, Boston or New York, but you can get skis for little or nothing and outfit them, you know, however you like to go out and enjoy skiing in the woods.
As we're on the idea of equipment, are there things that you should take with you in case you kind of wander off trail when you're doing backcountry?
Well, I'm glad that you asked that because, you know, people, yes, you are out in the mountains and you need to have, you know, the experience and knowledge to be out in the mountains in winter safely. And so, you know, some of the basics, I would really encourage people to, you know, you can learn these things. There are courses in backcountry skills, and I don't just mean ski skills, because ski skills you can learn in a variety of ways. You can learn them at a ski area or just by backcountry skiing. But we're talking about navigation, first aid, you know, just ways to ensure that you can deal with mishaps, repair gear. And if you're going on steep terrain, like in New Hampshire in particular, avalanches are a concern. They're a big concern if you ski out west. And you do need training in avalanche awareness, how to assess a slope, avoid avalanche terrain. You know, New England doesn't have a lot of avalanche-prone terrain, but we do have our share. So if you're on steep, treeless slopes, avalanches are definitely something you need to learn about, but not for a lot of the skiing we do, you know, around the Green Mountains.
And then are there other rules, like letting people know that you're headed out before you go backcountry?
Yeah, a lot of this would just be the basics that everyone from snowmobilers to ice fishermen, you know, yes, you want people to know where you are. Of course, bring a phone and expect it not to work.
Right. That's
so
right.
A phone is a really nice bonus if it works. But as anybody who's traveled in the Vermont mountains knows, they freeze, they're dead, there's no signal. There's a zillion things that conspire against a simple phone call to get you out of trouble. So you need to have, you know, extra clothing, headlamps, repair equipment, first aid equipment to deal with those mishaps to make sure they don't spiral into something more serious. So, and at a minimum, of course, letting people know where you are is the first insurance plan.
The book is The Best Backcountry Skiing in the Northeast. Now, I would imagine that at one time, I think people didn't really like to tell where were some good spots to do backcountry, but now you're sharing these. So you want to share a great place to backcountry in Vermont?
Absolutely. And you're right. You know, backcountry skiers are notoriously secretive. You know, we kind of slip off into the woods and hope nobody, you know, the only trace of us is our tracks. So all of that is true, but I'm a big believer in sharing. Mm-hmm. I love going, you know, skiing is way more fun when you do it with friends. So some of my favorite places, so I live in Waterbury, and as is often the case with skiers, it's the stuff that's closest to you, the stuff you can get out and enjoy, you know, for a half-day outing type of thing. So Camel's Hump, one of the places I write about is an area on Camel's Hump called Bald Hill, which is best accessed from Huntington. That's a great area for backcountry skiing. The whole backcountry there's a whole backcountry ski trail network in between the Trapp Family Lodge and Stowe Mountain Resort cross-country centers that they maintain with the help of others. And these are many of the historic trails that I was telling you about that were cut in the 1930s by the Civilian Conservation Corps. And these include things like the Steeple Trail and the Bruce Trail, all on the different sides of Mount Mansfield. And it is really, these are gems, and they are shining again. So almost 100 years old, but these trails are still pack a fantastic amount of adventure and fun.
How
so
Vermont.
Those are some of my favorites.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can join the conversation, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. And it's to the valley we go this time to talk to David. Hi, David. Go right ahead.
Hi. Just listening to you guys down there, listening to David. And I think one of the things he failed to mention that anybody backcountry skiing should keep in their backpack, and that is matches.
Oh, yeah, pretty basic thing.
Having grown up hunting in the central Vermont mountains, our father taught his five boys, you never go out in the woods without something to be able to start a fire, in case you have to. And that's all I have to say.
All right,
it's just
thanks.
One more thing that should be put in the backpack.
David Goodman, your thoughts on that?
Yes, that's a great thought, and for sure, everything you can do to be safe and anticipate mishaps. You know, I always like to think the goal is not to necessarily, you can't prevent all these mishaps, but you can certainly keep them from getting, more out of hand than they are. And Rick, I can't believe that we've gotten this far and we haven't even talked about Bernie's mittens yet.
Pair
of mittens like Bernie Sanders had at the inauguration, that'll get you far, too.
Do we know if Bernie has ever participated in any winter sports in Vermont? I know he's a transplant, but usually I moved here from.
I'm trying to think if I've seen a picture of him on skis that was. Nothing is leaping to mind. Peter Welch skis. I know the governor skis. I don't think I can recall seeing Senator Leahy on skis, but these guys are pretty busy, especially right now. So I'm gonna cut them.
I don't know. Judging from that kind of loose overcoat, a winter coat that Bernie had on yesterday, I'm gonna put him down as a rider. Yeah, that's what
It could be. It was a Burton jacket.
Yeah.
So I've been reading all about Bernie's fashion statement. So. I do want to, leave folks with resources for where to find out more about this stuff.
Excellent.
If they're listening and they're, so the website for my book is bestbackcountryskiing.com. But great resources locally are, as I mentioned before, the Catamount Trail Association has really been kind of the overseer and guardian and clearinghouse for all things backcountry skiing for many years. The Catamount Trail itself is a 300-mile-long backcountry ski trail that runs the length of Vermont. But it is the organization has expanded to include these community-based groups. So catamounttrail.org is really a good gateway to find out where there's good backcountry skiing near you, also listing group outings. There's a similar organization in New Hampshire called Granite Backcountry Alliance. Their website is theirname.org, and they similarly have all these community-supported skiing programs. So, we've got great resources locally. Bolton Valley has weekly backcountry ski clinics and guided stuff. They also rent backcountry ski gears. And a lot of our outdoor shops, Outdoor Gear Exchange in Burlington, Umiak Outfitters in Stowe, these are all places where you can try rent out backcountry ski equipment. So, I'd love to demystify it as much as possible so that as many people as we can get out. And there is, wherever you're listening, there is backcountry skiing near you. So I'm looking out the window as we're talking, and it is snowing hard in the Waterbury area. And, winter is definitely back, and this is a great way to be out in it.
Absolutely. You mentioned a great Vermont resource. We're going to turn to one now. Rusty's calling us. Hi, Rusty. Go right ahead.
Hey, thanks. Hey, great show, David. Thank you. Love to see the winter. I'm in a squall right now, hands-free. But if you could mention, I don't know if you have yet, but the hazards, the number one, two, and three hazards when someone's back in the woods putting through on their skis. Is it twigs? Is it, sinkholes, whatever? And good luck with the book.
That's a great question
from
Rusty.
Well, thanks, Rusty. Always good to hear Rusty, but I also, I really like hearing Rusty with a guitar or a fiddle next to him. But,
yep.
Hazards, he mentioned some there. Eye protection. This is Vermont. We got a lot of trees around. Just dressing right. That means no cotton. You only want wool or synthetic next to your skin so that you can stay warm when it's wet. Cotton, notoriously, once it gets wet, it's like a towel and it just soaks the warmth right out of you. Mm-hmm. So really basic things. Like dressing right, eye protection, having a hat, having extra clothing so that when the stuff you wear gets wet, those are all key pieces. And then, you know, my pack is always a little heavier than it needs to be because I've got repair and first aid gear and extra clothing, and not just for me, but I think about the people who I'm with. So I might bring an extra pair of gloves for, you know, you show up the trailhead, somebody's forgotten theirs, or, you know, their stuff gets soaked. So, you know, thinking on behalf of others that you're with is also a good thing. And, you know, again, I've already given my cautionary note about the cell phones. They're incredible, they're amazing, and they usually don't work.
Right.
So do not consider that your backup plan. Don't do dumb things thinking that help is just a phone call away.
Oh boy,
you will
point.
Typically pay a price for that. But most of all, just have fun. I mean, this is, we are so lucky to live where we live. I just feel that, you know, throughout this terrible pandemic, and it's taking such a toll on people, but the fact that we live in a place where we can just go out the door, be naturally socially distanced, and still get exercise, enjoy the thrill of our mountains. You know, we're very lucky. People are in the cities, and it's a lot more challenging. So, and I also think that backcountry skiing, you know, it's become where it once was a solitary thing to get away from it all.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's now a great community thing where people are coming together to create, you know, new trails and glades and, you know, or just backcountry ski outing, you know, evenings that they have at Bolton, things like that. It's a way that people are coming together. And I think community is so much of the solution to what ails us these days, finding new ways to come together.
Point well taken. Now, snowboarders have a certain vibe. Is there a culture or vibe of backcountry skiers?
Absolutely. I'm so glad you mentioned that. You know, the title of my book is Best Backcountry Skiing in the Northeast, but the subtitle is 50 Classic Ski and Snowboard Tours in New England and New York. So snowboarders are getting into the backcountry in two ways. You can snowshoe up and then, you know, with your snowboard on your back, or you can use split boards, which are snowboards that literally split in half lengthwise to become skis going uphill and then snap back together to become a snowboard on the descent. And you're using skins on the bottom of your snowboard, your split boards, just like you do with skis. And it enables people to, you know, snowboard all the things that we ski. So splitboarding is really a great other side of backcountry skiing that's allowing snowboarders to have as much fun as skiers.
And, David, with just about a minute and a half left, any other trails, maybe in Vermont or outside Vermont, that you really love?
You know, Mount Mansfield has been a magnet for backcountry skiers since the 1930s. There are backcountry ski trails on every side of it. So if you want to taste some of the history of backcountry skiing, go there. And I write about a variety of those trails in my book. But also, you know, I mentioned earlier a lot of defunct ski areas, Ascutney in eastern Vermont, Dutch Hill in southern Vermont, are all being brought back to life. That's a very exciting thing. In the Northeast Kingdom, the area around Lake Willoughby has been developed for backcountry skiing. There is an incredible amount of new terrain, even more than you might have thought just 10 years ago. So the most important thing is that you go, and finding places to go is now the easy part because I've written a guide to it, but there are other resources as well. So just get out in the snow and enjoy it.
What great advice. I hope we haven't kept you from getting out there today.
Well, I've been seeing it stack up here as we talk, and it is making me rethink my afternoon plans.
Oh, I love it. David Goodman is an expert on backcountry skiing. The new book is called Best Backcountry Skiing in the Northeast, 50 Classic Ski and Snowboard Tours in New England and New York. And the website is bestbackcountry.com. David Goodman, it was so much fun.
Bestbackcountryskiing.com.
Oh, sorry. You got it.
All right. Okay.
Bestbackcountryskiing.com.
But thank you, Rick.
Thank you, David. It was a lot of fun.
Okay.
CBS News is next, then we'll be back to learn about prosopagnosia, or face blindness. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Here we are into January, still in a pandemic, but there is hope on the horizon. At the Warren Store, renovations are wrapping up. The new deli is rocking hard with old favorites and new menu items like French fries. The grab-and-go dinners are to die for, delicious, generous, full-course meals. Check out our website, warrenstore.com, for daily offerings. Upstairs, we have a new look in the ladies' department and, wait for it, heat and air conditioning. Still fun, friendly, and funky. Main Street, Warren Village. New hours, 7:30 to 5 o'clock daily.
We're back with Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Zingari. The first time someone told me about prosopagnosia, or face blindness, I thought they were making it up. Like, I was being punked, but with something that sounded a bit out there, but just this side of believable. Thank goodness for search engines. It is a thing, and we have an expert researcher on the subject right here in the area. Before I even attempt to discuss the details of it, I'm going to quickly introduce him and start firing questions at him so that you get the facts on this without me muddling it. With me is Brad Duchesne. He's professor of psychological and brain sciences at Dartmouth College. Brad, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Listeners, if you'd like to check out some cool stuff about prosopagnosia while we're talking, you can go to faceblind.org. That's a website of Brad's, and faceblind.org. It'll help maybe as we discuss this. If you've got questions or comments for Brad Duchesne, you can call us at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. That is 877-291-TALK, and you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. As I mentioned, Brad, I'm not going to try to muddle things, so let's start with the basics. And what is prosopagnosia?
Sure. So prosopagnosics are people who have great difficulty recognizing facial identity. So they might, for example, you know, they know somebody, they work with them quite well. Then there's the grocery store. They run into that person, and they don't know who the person is. Maybe they can figure out who the person is from their voice or the things they're talking about, but from the face, they have a really tough time working that out.
Are there classic symptoms that would tell us that someone is prosopagnosic?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's sort of things you probably guess. I mean, so if you know somebody really well, and you have a tough time recognizing that person, let's say friends, family, you know, acquaintances that you know really well. That's the main sign. Another thing we often hear from prosopagnosics is that they have a tough time following movies and television shows. So, for example, a lot of them complain about the movie The Departed, where you've got a lot of young guys about the same age, fairly similar look, and they just can't keep track of the different actors.
Wow, that's something I never would have thought of, that you're watching a movie with someone, and because we recognize the faces so easily, prosopagnosic wouldn't, and would have trouble following along. So is there an easy or effective way, then, to diagnose that somebody really does have face blindness?
Yeah, what we do in my lab, and the way other labs around the world work, is first you want to hear about the person's experiences. And then if they sound like they're prosopagnosic, then you can run them on computer-based tests. So we use two different types of tests to assess people's face recognition. So first, we just look to see how well they do recognizing famous faces. And so we take a set of, we typically have 60 famous faces, and we crop out all the hair. So it's just the inner face. And they have to tell us who the person is. We don't give any information about them. At the end of the test, then we go back, and we, you know, of course, you can't recognize famous faces if you're not familiar with them, so then we go back and ask them about their exposure to those particular people. And typically on our tests, if somebody with normal face recognition recognizes something like 50 out of 60 of those faces and a very high percentage of the faces they're familiar with, and our prosopagnosics might recognize, say, from 0 to 30, something like that. The difficulty, of course, with famous face tests, though, is that, you know, everybody has a variable amount of exposure to famous faces just because some people have seen celebrities more than others. And so we also use tests of unfamiliar face recognition where we train people on tests at the start of the test, say, train them on six faces, and then they have to try to recognize those faces later on in the test. And so with tests like that, everybody's starting at the same point, and so the score that you get at the end of the test is really a fair comparison.
You've done a lot of research on this field, Brad. What was it that drew you to this?
I was really interested in the organization of the brain generally, and sort of one of the big debates or questions within psychology and neuroscience for many, many years is sort of, is the brain divided into sort of mechanisms that are specialized for particular tasks, or is it a much more general organization? And so one of the best examples of that when I got it, when I was in graduate school, was face recognition. It looked like face recognition appeared to be carried out by a specialized mechanism. And yet there was evidence sort of in the other direction as well. And so I was interested in that debate, and so I thought face processing would be a great place to investigate it. And then I was fortunate enough to just sort of luck into somebody with prosopagnosia, and that got the ball rolling for me.
And is there a spot in our brain that helps us recognize faces?
Yeah, there's not just a spot. In fact, there are multiple regions that do it, so that you can think of about a network of brain regions. The first area that's probably the area that's most important is an area called the right fusiform gyrus, and there's an area there that responds especially strongly to faces, and so this is in your temporal lobe. And this region that's face selective is kind of blueberry-sized, and if that gets damaged, you're going to have trouble with face recognition. But that area communicates with, it depends on how you count them, but maybe say 12 to 14 other areas within your brain that are also involved in face processing. And so if you damage those other areas, that's going to affect how you process faces, or if you disconnect the area, so you say sever the connections between those different areas, you can end up with face processing problems.
Mm. How much do you understand of the causes of prosopagnosia?
At a high level, we have a good understanding. We say, well, we know which brain regions tend to cause prosopagnosia. What we don't have an understanding of is what are those brain areas doing specifically, sort of what sort of information processing goes on in them. And that's one of the things we're trying to explore with prosopagnosia. Particularly, one thing I should mention is there's two different types of prosopagnosia. In acquired prosopagnosia, and this is the type of prosopagnosia we've known about for a century and a half. These are people who had normal face recognition and then suffered brain damage and lost their ability to recognize faces. The other type is developmental prosopagnosia, and these are people who never suffered any brain damage, and so they just, for whatever reason, didn't develop the mechanisms you need for face processing. We think in many cases it's due to genetic problems. But in the acquired cases, often you'll have a person's got a quite selective lesion, and so if they've got a particular part of their brain that's knocked out, you can then do a lot of behavioral testing with them to try to say, well, what can they do normally? What can they not do normally? And that's a way to provide insight into what the particular region within the face network is doing.
Acquired and developmental, is one more severe than the other, have you found?
Probably at its worst, acquired prosopagnosia is worse than developmental, but I've seen developmental prosopagnosics who are quite tuned in terms of, say famous people, and they don't recognize a single famous face. So both can be quite severe. Developmental is much more common than acquired prosopagnosia. We didn't know about developmental prosopagnosia, say, 20 years ago. There had only been a case or two published, so it appeared to be really rare. Mm. But what we've realized in the last 20 or so years is there are a lot of people out there who have a tough time recognizing faces, so tough that it really impacts them on a daily basis.
Wow. So the way our brain operates, differing from someone who can recognize faces to someone who cannot recognize faces, how is that the brain that is non-prosopagnosic compared to prosopagnosic functioning?
Yeah. What we see is I mean, say sort of the way you described it is just right. I mean, you can think about it as a spectrum from people with really poor face recognition ability to really good face recognition ability. Yeah, maybe we'll talk later about those people who are really good.
Good.
What we see is, I mean, these are kind of crude measures that we've got when we, so fMRI is functional MRI. So many of us have had MRI scans, say you've got, you break a leg or something, and you want to, they do a scan to try to get a better understanding about the structure there. With functional MRI, you're measuring brain activity in response to stimuli that are being presented. And so we might present people with faces. We'll also present them with objects. And then what we do is we look, we contrast the response in that person's brain to faces and objects. And that's how we find those face selective areas. Those are the areas that respond a lot more strongly to faces than to objects. What we find in people who have better face recognition is that they show a stronger response within those face selective areas than people who have poor face recognition. Now, the people with poor face recognition, they usually have the same areas. They just aren't operating quite as aren't quite as active as what you see in people with good face recognition.
Can you develop those if you know they're not quite as developed? Can you help them in certain ways, exercises that can help them with facial recognition?
Yeah, that's a great question. You certainly see over childhood that people, these face selective areas, some of the face selective areas become, they show a stronger response as people get older. We don't know why that is. It could be because they're practicing face recognition. It could just be a maturational process. With regard to the developmental prosopagnosics, there are several labs that have looked into training programs, and there have been some sort of encouraging but pretty modest improvements that you see both in terms of people's ability to recognize faces in daily life, as well as there have been a few changes that have been noted within these face areas. You see a little stronger response, but it's certainly, we aren't very far along when it comes to developing interventions.
Let's talk about how it manifests itself in those who have it. And why don't we start with, like, children or young adults?
Sure, yeah. With children, it can be really tough for the people, or the children themselves or the people around them to recognize that they're having a tough time recognizing faces. So kids, they imagine a kid, for example, he's in a classroom, and the teacher asks him, hey, can you pass these assignments back to the students? And the student might know that they don't have a chance, that there's no way they'll be able to do that, and so they say, no, I don't want to do that, and they come across as resistant, and everybody's puzzled by it. You know, this kid's really normal, nice in normal situations, but there seem to be some situations where they have a tough time. Mm-hmm. When kids go to school where the kids are wearing uniforms, they really have a tough time. And that's something not surprising to hear from adults, say, once they join the military, for example. They're just overwhelmed by everybody wearing the same clothes and not being able to use clothes to recognize them. And so it can be really tough for people to sort of figure that out in kids. And it's an important moment when the caretakers of a child do figure it out, and sort of, because it makes sense of so many things. They say, oh, now I understand why that kid was reluctant to say, go join that group of kids that they knew well, because they didn't realize that they knew those children well.
Well, we just got an email from Vicky, and boy, it couldn't be more appropriately timed. Vicky writes, I would imagine that people with this condition would avoid social situations, including going to the store or other public places. They may also be perceived as antisocial or stuck up. Let's talk about it in everyday life of a person, an adult person who has prosopagnosia and is not able to recognize faces.
Yeah, she's absolutely right. I mean, I hear from a lot of prosopagnosics who avoid social situations where they're going to have a tough time recognizing faces because they just run into trouble. They might go to a restaurant with a group of people. Imagine they have to meet a group of people at a bar where you don't know where people are going to be. That's really tough for them. I hear stories of people they're with a group of people, they go back to the bathroom, then they come back and sit down at the wrong table because they don't recognize the people that they're around. And prosopagnosics are often viewed as aloof because they don't, you know, react to people the same way. Imagine you're in an elevator and your supervisor gets on and you don't acknowledge your supervisor. Well, that doesn't go over
Well. Wow. Do they have problems? I mean, that's somebody pretty close they work with every day. Do they have problems with loved ones recognizing them?
They can, yeah, absolutely, sure. So we have prosopagnosics who, you know, they don't recognize their brother will come into work unexpectedly to the place that the prosopagnosic works. Brother comes in. I remember somebody saying that she didn't recognize her brother. She was talking to this guy for a while. Then all of a sudden she sort of, something went off. Maybe his voice tipped her off, and she realized she's talking to her brother. We hear from a fair amount of parents who will take their child to daycare, drop them off. For one reason or another, the kids had to change clothes during the day. They'll go back. They won't know which child is theirs. These are the sorts of events that where people sort of knew something was wrong, but when there's an event like that where you don't recognize your child, then people say, okay, something's going on here. I'm going to go Google can't recognize faces. And then they realize, oh, there are a lot of people like me who have a tough time recognizing faces, and it really helps them make sense of lots of events in their life.
Brad, do they have, prosopagnosics, do they have difficulty in certain professions or skills?
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly they have a tougher time in some professions than others. So imagine trying to be a teacher if you can't recognize your students' faces. I mean, there are a lot of teachers out there, so of course there are a lot of prosopagnosic teachers. I've heard from many people over the years who've had to manage that, but it can be really tough. You know, they'll do things like have assigned seating and things like that, but you know, there are many situations where you're going to need to recognize people when they're away from their desk.
Now, during this pandemic, we've been walking around with masks over half of our faces, so has that made it more difficult for prosopagnosics to recognize people?
Yeah, it has. I mean, just like us, it makes it more difficult for them. And, you know, I should maybe point out, prosopagnosics' ability to recognize faces, it's not zero. They can do it. So when we give them a famous face test, maybe they'll recognize a third of the faces. And they know it's going to be somebody famous, so that helps them narrow it down. But they have a tougher time. And so covering the face up with a mask also makes it more difficult for them. I've heard though some prosopagnosics who kind of like it because now they've got an excuse for when they didn't recognize somebody.
Oh, good point. Oh, touche. I do like that. I want to flip back to something we talked a little bit about earlier, and that was kind of the opposite of prosopagnosia, someone who is really good at recognizing faces. Is that a thing?
Yeah, absolutely. So, back maybe like 13, 14 years ago, there was a lot of media interest in prosopagnosia, so there were articles being written in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. And we would hear from, after those articles would be published, people would contact me directly. And once in a while, I'd hear from people who'd say, I'm not that. I'm the opposite. I'm fantastic when it comes to face recognition. I never forget a face. And so we heard from enough of these people that a couple colleagues and I decided to put them to the test. And so to do that, we had to make our tests more difficult, like by adding, making the occluding parts of the face. And we also created tests involving famous faces, but we used, we call them the before they were famous test. And there's lots of these sorts of tests out on the web right now. So you know, you find a photo of Obama when he was 6 years old and you try to see if people can recognize him. We found four of these people were just fantastic on these tests, far better than any of the normal participants that we ran. And since that time, there have been a lot of labs around the world working with these so-called super recognizers.
Wow.
And, they're really extraordinary. I mean, they sort of in daily life, they have interesting strategies. So, for example, they say, you know, it took me a while to figure this out, but I realized that I can't say to somebody, oh, yeah, I remember seeing you at the supermarket 3 years ago, because that weirds people out. Let's say that's just the one time they met the person. So they have to sort of hold back and not admit how often that they are actually recognizing people. They, for example, before realizing that other people aren't like them, some told me that they thought others were phony. So somebody would be introduced to them multiple times, and the person would have no recollection of having met them before. They think, you know, she knows me. She's pretending that she doesn't know me.
Wow. Hey, we're going to go to the phones. We've got Kitty calling in from Orange. Kitty, thanks for calling. Go right ahead.
Yes, I'd like to know about your research in reference to autism spectrum disorder because of cues missed with ADHD kids. And, of course, there's always new labels on things, and I don't know for sure that I'm up on the latest labels, but I really would be interested in that because this sounds like it could have some sort of connection to me, and it would be extremely interesting to delve into that.
Yeah, I'm sure, Brad, you're asked this quite a bit. So is there a connection? What have you learned?
Yeah, Katie, that's a really good question. What research has shown with people with autism spectrum disorder is that many of them do have a tough time with facial identity recognition. We tested, in a previous job I had, we tested a good number of people with, they had a particular type of ASD, which is called Asperger's syndrome. In which you have a lot of the social difficulties, but language is normal in people with Asperger's syndrome. We found that almost all of those people did poorly on our sort of best test of facial identity recognition. We also, when we looked at other aspects of face process, I've been focused here in the interview on facial identity recognition, so knowing who somebody is. But, of course, there's a lot of other information that we get from the face, so, you know, looking at facial expressions to see how somebody's feeling right then, reading their eyes to see where somebody's looking, trying to assess somebody's age based on their face, those sorts of things. And what we found sort of across the board on the tests we ran is that this group of people with Asperger's syndrome did poorly with face processing. And that's similar to what other labs have shown as well. What they tend to have the greatest difficulty with of the different parts of face processing is facial expression recognition. So they have a tough time, you know, knowing whether somebody is making a fearful face or a disgusted face, that sort of thing.
We just have about a minute to the break, Brad, but how does someone with face blindness compensate for it?
Yeah, so in daily life, we all use things other than the face to recognize people. So we might use their hair, we might use their body shape, the way that they move. The context is important for us. So, you know, prosopagnosics do much better at recognizing somebody, say, in the office than if they run into them at the grocery store. Because at the grocery store, it could be anybody, whereas at the office, you've got a small group of people you're going to run into. Mm-hmm. So prosopagnosics have to rely on those other cues to person recognition that the rest of us use, but they just have to rely on them a lot more heavily.
We're going to take a break for CBS News, then we'll be back to continue this fascinating discussion on prosopagnosia with Dartmouth professor Brad Duchesne. Listeners, if you'd like to join in, any questions you have, if you suspect you might be somewhat prosopagnosic, you can call us, 244-1777. Toll free, it's 877-291-8255. That's 877-291-TALK. You can email VTViewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Here we are into January, still in a pandemic, but there is hope on the horizon. At the Warren Store, renovations are wrapping up. The new deli is rocking hard with old favorites and new menu items like French fries. The grab-and-go dinners are to die for, delicious, generous, full-course meals. Check out our website, warrenstore.com, for daily offerings. Upstairs, we have a new look in the ladies' department and, wait for it, heat and air conditioning. Still fun, friendly, and funky. Main Street, Warren Village. New hours, 7:30 to 5 o'clock daily.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Prosopagnosia is our topic du jour, and don't worry if you're not an expert. We have Dartmouth College Professor Brad Duchesne with us this morning, who is. If you've got a question or a comment for Professor Duchesne, you can give us a call at 244-1777, 877-291-8255, or email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. It's usually at this point in the discussion when people start to think they have face blindness. So, Brad, let's explore a few things about what percent of people really do have prosopagnosia.
Our best estimate suggests it's going to be something like 2%. So one out of 50 people have trouble with face recognition so severe that it really impacts their daily life.
And I hear a lot, as soon as I start talking to people about this, they say, I can't remember people's names. So is that a thing? If somebody isn't good with names, could they be prosopagnosic?
If having trouble with names was a condition, we'd all have that one, I think. So that's not what we're talking about here. So prosopagnosics, they will encounter a face that they've seen many times, and they won't realize it's somebody they know. Whereas I think the experience that most of us have is we see somebody, we know that we know that person, but we can't remember their name. That's quite different and something that's very common.
All right. And then not being able to place someone when we see them kind of outside their normal setting or outside of the normal context.
Yeah, no, so that's not it. So
yeah.
You know the person. You just can't figure out who it is, and maybe you'll think about it for a while and maybe work it out. So that's typical.
All right. We had a caller who asked this question, Brad. Cindy wanted to know if kids who don't recognize names, if it's because of the use of so much technology these days and cell phone use.
And was Cindy specifically asking about recognizing names?
I'm sorry, recognizing faces.
Oh,
I apologize.
Okay. Yeah, we don't have any reason to think that it's becoming more common than it used to be, but it would be tough for us to know for sure. So I don't have any reason to believe that that's true, but that we don't have good evidence about it, that question.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that this research is only so old. When was prosopagnosia first detected?
Yeah, so the first time that it appeared in the neurological literature there was a mention of it in a book by a London neurologist in 1844. There were just sporadic reports, let's say every 5 to 10 years in the neurological literature. And then in 1947, there was a paper where the term prosopagnosia was first introduced. And prosopo means face in Greek, and then agnosia means not knowing. And so this was a paper by a German neurologist named Bodemer. And he studied three people. I think they all had head wounds from World War II, or if not, two of them did. And they were unable to recognize, well, two out of three of them were unable to recognize faces. The other had some abnormal perceptual experiences with faces. And Bodemer, from that paper in 1947, argued, well, when we recognize a face, we're using a different part of our brain than when we recognize, say, a car or a chair or a place, things like that. And so he was really arguing for face specificity there based on these neurological cases. So that was 47, and going forward, there were additional acquired prosopagnosia cases. But it wasn't until 1976 when the first developmental case was reported. And even for, say, 20 years after that, we still thought that developmental version was very uncommon. But then with the advent of the Internet, that allowed people with developmental prosopagnosia first to just find each other on the Internet, and then that allowed them to find researchers. And so the Internet's really been a boon to people like me who are neuropsychologists and are trying to find people with these rare conditions.
And I should mention again, speaking of the Internet, Brad's website is faceblind.org. Very interesting website for you to explore more about prosopagnosia if you're interested after this program, faceblind.org. So when it was first detected and kind of written about, in the medical community. Was it accepted? You know, how was it accepted, I guess, when the initial research and first came out?
Yeah, I think people, you know, I don't have a good feel because it was so long ago, but
right.
I think it was, you know, accepted that if you suffered damage to certain parts of your brain, you could lose the ability to recognize faces. There were debates over sort of how specific it could be. Was it really just affecting faces in some cases, or was it broader than that? But I think among neurologists, it's still ongoing. It's taken people a long time to realize that there are a lot of developmental cases out there. So I wrote my dissertation on a guy who was a developmental prosopagnosic who lived in San Francisco, and this guy named Bill Schozer. And Bill had a tough time when he first realized that came to the realization that he might be prosopagnosic. He went to see physicians about this, and they told him, if you haven't suffered brain damage, you can't be prosopagnosic, because at the time we didn't really know much about developmental prosopagnosia. Mm-hmm. And so he was quite frustrated in his interactions with neurologists and whoever the other physicians that he saw. This is something I hear from people from time to time. I think word has gotten out about prosopagnosia over the last 20 years, and so I think your typical physician has probably at least heard of it now, whereas that might not have been the case in the past.
It must be fascinating for a physician to have, to actually meet someone with prosopagnosia for the first time and see it kind of manifest that, I'm not trying to make an example out of a person who has it, but I guess, you know, doctors, the first time they've been hearing about something like this, it would be interesting to have a patient. But are there any other or other perception problems that are common to those who have face blindness?
Yeah, so there are a number of things that tend to co-occur with prosopagnosia. And when I say co-occur, I don't mean they appear with it every time,
mm-hmm.
but they're more likely to appear. And so we see people who have a tough time recognizing faces. They tend to have a tough time making sense of the other information in the face. So maybe about 25% of the people with developmental prosopagnosia have trouble reading facial expressions or, say, telling how old somebody is. And so I remember hearing a story from a guy. He said, I go up to two girls at the mall. This is when he was like 20 years old. And I started hitting on them. And then I realized that they were a mother and a daughter. And I just can't perceive age well in faces. Mm-hmm. He ended that like saying something like, my life is a sitcom. and so they have trouble with reading age, that sort of thing. Beyond faces, they're more likely to have trouble recognizing just objects. So they might have trouble recognizing their car in a parking lot. Another problem that a good proportion of prosopagnosics have is that they have trouble with navigation. So they have trouble sort of understanding the spatial layout, say, of their neighborhood, the city they live in. And this is something in acquired prosopagnosia. So when people have suffered brain damage and lost their ability to recognize faces, it's something like a third to 50% of those people have severe navigational problems. So that goes with it quite commonly.
Now, we talked earlier about, some of the ways that someone with face blindness will compensate. And will this help them the next time they see the person and the next? Or, they pick up a cue, like whatever it might be, hair or what they're wearing. How much does that help them then, continue to recognize that person?
Yeah, these strategies that they come up with, I think they're helpful. They're not as good as, their ability to recognize people still isn't as good as it would be if they could recognize faces normally. But I think it's good that they use these. And they talk about, like Bill Schozer, the guy I wrote my dissertation on, Bill talked about key traits. And Bill would really focus on people's hair and the pants that they wore. His explanation for this is that he grew up in a small town in the Ozarks in the 40s. And he said, every kid almost every day wore the same pair of jeans. We didn't have much, so everybody wore the same clothes. And so I really learned to recognize people just based on their jeans. And 50 years later, he was still using these same strategies to recognize people. I remember we were walking along
talking one day, and he mentioned, "Oh yeah, I remember you wore those 505s with some irregularity on the back of the right leg, and I didn't even know about this sort of damage that I'd suffered on the back of my leg. I checked him when I got back home. Oh yeah, sure enough, Phil was right." So he was really tuned into those. I mean, you'll hear other people, people say, I use teeth, for example, or in the winter, people tend to wear the same boots each day, so I focus on their boots.
Wow. Oh, those are fantastic. I'm thinking of President Chester A. Arthur, who owned 80 different pairs of pants. Would have been difficult for Bill Schozer to recognize him, but he did have those big lamb chop sideburns, so maybe that's what he would have focused on. And we go to Corinth, where Forbes is calling. Hi, Forbes. I'm great. How you doing?
Good. Quick question.
Yeah.
Is this a problem, an earmarker or a prelude to dementia?
Oh, great question, Forbes. Is there any link that you've found, Brad Duchaine, between prosopagnosia and dementia?
There have been some cases reported where people become prosopagnosic due to some degenerative diseases. I don't think it's a common one. It's not something that say clinicians are on the lookout for, but I think if any time you see a change in a cognitive or perceptual ability, sort of a really noticeable change as one gets older, I think it's worth talking to a neurologist or a physician about.
And Brad, are you looking for people to take part in studies on face blindness?
Absolutely, yeah. So we're always on the lookout for new people who are interested in participating in our studies, both acquired prosopagnosics and developmental prosopagnosics. So that's one of the main purposes of our website, faceblind.org, that you mentioned. We've got a contact form, and so if there are people out there listening who are interested in, who think that they're prosopagnosic and are interested in participating in research, I encourage them to get in touch with us through our website.
What kind of tests would you put them through?
What we typically do is we'll run people on a few tests remotely, so just over the internet, and we'll have them do the sorts of tests I mentioned that we use for diagnostic purposes, so famous face tests or tests of unfamiliar face recognition where you study a set of faces and try to recognize them later. And we're gearing up right now. We've got an NIH grant that we're trying to prepare tasks for, both behavioral tasks, so computer-based tasks, as well as imaging tasks, where we'll put people into the scanner to see what their brain's doing. We're hoping to scan 60 prosopagnosics for that, and we're probably going to have to bring people in from pretty far afield, so it's wonderful for us when there are people in Vermont, New Hampshire, who can come over, you know, without traveling from Chicago. So we'd love to hear from local people.
How long have you been researching this, Brad?
I think it was 1990. It was either 1997 or 1998 when I first got into this. I was running experiments just on normal college students, and involving face recognition though, and those were going nowhere. And right about that time, just through a family friend, I was fortunate enough to get in touch with a prosopagnosic. He was a 17-year-old boy down in the Los Angeles area, and I started testing him, and then after that, his family pointed me to Bill Schozer, the guy up in San Francisco I wrote my dissertation on. Bill had a website, which I think is still up, called FaceBlind with an exclamation point. Mm-hmm. And I got in touch with Bill, and then, like a lot of grad students, I created a website that talked a little about my research. And after that, I started hearing from people every 2 or 3 weeks, and I realized, well, there are actually a lot of people out there. I thought it was a really rare condition, and after we created faceblind.org, we first posted that in 2002, I hear from, say, 2 to 3 people per day. I mean, they're coming from all over the world, but
wow.
There are a lot of people out there.
And people can go to faceblind.org to you know, get in contact with you, but there's a lot of information. Tell people what they'll find at faceblind.org.
Sure, yeah. We try to help people understand what it's like to be prosopagnosic, so people can assess whether they think they're actually prosopagnosic. So we talk about the daily experiences that prosopagnosics have. We talk a little about the brain basis of prosopagnosia. We have links to the papers that we publish about prosopagnosis, so if people really want to look at the details, they can look at that. We publish, or I should say, we try to publish a newsletter every 6 months. We just don't always get it out on time. But in those newsletters, we have, say, sometimes we have first-person stories from prosopagnosics in there. We talk about some of the famous prosopagnosics who are out there. Like we did an interview, Oliver Sacks is one of the more well-known developmental prosopagnosics, the well-known neurologist and writer. And we talk about sort of some of the latest research in our newsletters as well.
I think people would be surprised. I want to focus on the famous prosopagnosics, but they'd be surprised to know that John Hickenlooper, a politician, is prosopagnosic, ran for president. He was, I think governor of Colorado. But that has got to be, when I talked earlier about professions that might be more difficult for someone with prosopagnosia, a politician. So how did he compensate as he ran and won different races?
Yeah, that's a great question. And not only that, before he got into politics, he started a microbrewery and bar. And so he was able to see people at the bar all the time. I just, in our next newsletter, we were going to have a segment on John Hickenlooper since he just was sworn in 2 weeks ago. He's an interesting story. So he seemed, prosopagnosics tend to go one of two routes when it comes to interacting with people. They can sort of become standoffish because they don't know who the people are. Some people take the opposite route. They're friendly to everybody because they say, well, maybe I'll be friendly to a stranger, but that's not all that bad. Is that a big problem? And so I think Hickenlooper tends to go down that second route where he's friendly with lots of people. And I was reading an article the other day about him when he was out on the campaign trail during the primaries. And he said, when I go into someplace, I'll prep with my aides about sort of somebody's story. And people will introduce themselves to me, and I'll know who that person is because I've sort of read over their name and who the person is. And, I know I can handle that sort of information about that person just fine. And that's what people want to know. They don't want to know that I can recognize their face. They want to know that I remember the story that they told me, when I was through here 2 months ago. But it's challenging. I in this newsletter bit that we're going to have about John Hickenlooper, I'm also going to link to an article about Mitt Romney's time as the governor of Massachusetts. And there's an article, I think it was either New York Times or Boston Globe, talking about the many times that Mitt didn't recognize people in the State House in Boston. And they never mentioned prosopagnosia in the article. People saw it as Mitt not caring about them, which is a common explanation for prosopagnosia.
Wow.
So I suspect there might even be two prosopagnosics in the Senate right now.
Oh, very interesting. Wow, that's kind of breaking news. Quite possibly Mitt Romney, who also has run for president. So prosopagnosia does not hold you back. You could almost
hold
the highest office in the land. There's something else you've been working on, and we have a few minutes to talk about it, so I'm going to bring it up. It's called HEMI-PMO. What's that about?
Yeah, that's a mouthful. So the full name is prosopometamorphopsia, and there's two different ways this comes. So you mentioned HEMI. So in any sort of prosopometamorphopsia, there are distortions to the face. So somebody with this condition will look at a face, and the facial features will not appear right. They'll droop. They'll shrink. They'll become enlarged, discolored. And in full face, it's the whole face. But actually, the more common type of PMO is this HEMI-PMO. And in HEMI-PMO, one half of the face, and the division is vertical, so splitting sort of right down the nose, one half of the face appears distorted. The other half looks normal. So this is a really wild condition. We published a paper on a gentleman in Portugal over the summer who he was sitting watching television, and he noticed that one side of the face, the right side of the face, from his perspective, the right side of the faces that he was looking at were distorted. He described them like a Dali painting, sort of melting down, and he was disturbed by this. So he got up, and he went and looked in the mirror, and when he looked in the mirror, the right side of his face was showing similar sorts of distortions. And this is the condition often doesn't last all that long. It might last a week or something like that. Unfortunately, for this gentleman, it's been going on for 6 years now. And sometimes it's to the right side. In people, it's always to one side, but some patients experience it on the right side of the face. others on the left side.
And this is only on faces. It's not everything they're seeing.
No, so that's one of the really neat things about it that provides evidence that face processing is a different sort of processing than other sorts of processing. So this gentleman in Portugal only experiences it for faces. We showed him lots of other stimuli, and he doesn't experience it when he looks at hands, for example, doesn't look at it with body parts, cars, things like that, just the face. And like if it's just that right side of the face, so if a face turns in profile so that he can't see the right side of the face, there's no distortion on it at all. So that left side of the face looks perfectly normal for him.
That is amazing. The brain is fascinating, isn't it, Brad Duchaine?
Absolutely.
I mean, do you ever wake up and say, oh, this is kind of a boring study field to be involved in?
Definitely not. Yeah, I'm not going to be out of work anytime soon because we've got a long way to go in understanding it.
I absolutely love hearing about this, and Brad and I have talked about this before, and people remember interviews with Brad Duchaine. They'll say, yeah, you did a lot of great interviews, but man, that one about the guy with face blindness, that was the most fascinating thing I've ever heard. It's still, to me this day, Brad, I'm still fascinated by everything you say, so I want to thank you so much for the work you do. It's Brad Duchaine. He's a professor of psychological and brain sciences at Dartmouth College. And as we mentioned a few times today, to learn more, faceblind.org. Brad, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for having me on, Rick.
All right, you take care. And that is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Taylor Dobbs and directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Please feel free to suggest topics, guests, always looking. And you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.